This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Scotland Outdoors podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As we say every week, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week it's Tree-tastic as we mark National Tree Week.
It's pretty gloomy here this morning, but a single star is shining between the branches of the trees. Actually, poetic though that is, it's a black lie, there's another one up there. But never mind. Hello, good morning. I'm Mark Stephen. Right beside me, the other side of the fire, which has newly been put on, Rachel Stewart.
Aye, newly been put on within seconds.
Within seconds of the start of the programme.
We'd no fire lighters this morning, so I was looking forward to see how you were going to go on just rubbing two sticks together. We do have a flame.
We've got it going. I'm laughing.
Chilly this morning.
I
was looking at social media last night and Braemar Mountain Rescue posted a picture. Yeah. They'd been at a call out at the Lecht and it's whiteout conditions. Mm. So we've nothing to moan about really, but it is definitely a lot chillier.
No, excellent.
Yeah, anyway. What will you be up to today? Will you be heading to the hills to escape the Christmas chaos? Apparently it's about 4 weeks to Christmas, can you believe that?
Oh, I've got all the stuff wrapped, ready, you name it.
Yeah, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. Do let us know what you're up to. You can get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or you can text us 80295 or give us a ring 08085 92 95 00.
Coming up this morning, we're going to be celebrating National Tree Week. And you knew it was National Tree Week. Everybody knows it's National Tree Week as I visit Big Tree Country. Let us know if you have a favourite tree.
Yeah, or a favourite tree that you've planted.
Or if you're annoyed about school dinners, that's another thing.
You must have planted a few trees in your time.
Yeah, not hugely successful. The last two I planted, I've got a 50% kill rate.
Oh dear. Continuing the tree theme, I meet a green woodworker. What's one of those, I hear you ask? Well, all will be revealed a little later on.
Was he unwell? Had he gone off?
Yeah, he's gone off. And first, as always, of course, we've got your mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
I don't know that one.
No, neither do I.
Tempted to think it's a bird, but it's not.
Do you not think so?
Don't think so. Mm-hmm.
No. Okay. Again, those details to get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295. Or it's Sky here, manning the phones this morning, 08085 92 95 00. Those are sparky sticks. I think I'm going to catch a light.
If you're worried about the sparkiness of the sticks, you bring in the sticks for a change.
Oh, it's going to be one of those mornings.
Oh, that's it. Nippy.
Last week, Mark, you mentioned that you heard a blackbird hum.
Right.
This has piqued the interest of Ian McMillan, who got in touch to say, "Dear Mark and Rachel, hello from Australia, where I listen regularly to the podcast while trudging around the trails of Canberra. On the subject of birds that hum, as distinct from hummingbirds, which are a different kettle of fish, I wanted to mention..."
Could he have written a more confusing sentence than that?
He just likes to get as many species in as possible.
Exactly.
I wanted to mention that the magnificent Australian magpie is an excellent closed-beak vocalist and potential ventriloquist.
He goes on, he says, "One of the magpie's vocalisations is known as warbling. This is a soft and very melodious song, often delivered by a closed-beak, solitary bird sitting on a branch on a warm afternoon. In her seminal work, Australian Magpie, Professor Gisela Kaplan has quite a lot to say about this song, including the comment that warbling is a low-end energy in complex form of song and suggestions of similarity with humming in a human voice may not be far-fetched. So it's good to know that Mark's humming analogy, here you go, is not far-fetched. The song is usually produced in the syrinx, meaning that opening the beak is not necessary. Thank you for your wonderful programme. It takes me back to the country of family life back in 1970. Best wishes, Ian McMillan.
Oh, fantastic.
So Australian magpies do it and Scottish blackbirds do it.
Yeah. So you are onto something after all.
I think so. I think yeah. I've touched on something there. Earlier this week, I was at the Royal Highland Centre at Ingleston, just outside Edinburgh, for the annual event in the farming calendar known as AgriScot. Now, it's an event where all those interested in the latest business and technical developments in farming meet up along with trade standholders and livestock and everything else. Bob Carruth, Communications Director of the National Farmers Union of Scotland, gave me some background to the event.
It's carved out a really unique place in the Scottish farming calendar. You know, I think there'll be 8,000 or 9,000 people here today, and there's something for everyone. I think people come here for the political debate. I think some people come for the livestock, and there's great displays of livestock here. But a lot of people come here to do business. And, you know, I think, you know, when you get to speak to some of the standholders at the end of the day, the reason they keep coming back to AgriScot and the reason why AgriScot still remains such a successful event is people come here to do business, and that's the real core of it.
How long does your family connection go back with us?
Oh, well, certainly I've been coming to this when it was originally a very dairy-focused event, so DairyScot back in the day. Certainly my father would come to look at the cows, and my wee brother would come with a list of standholders that he wanted to get round and do a bit of business. So yeah, we've been coming for many years now. But I certainly welcome the development in the show. You know, it's moved away from that single focus event. There still is a bit of dairy emphasis, and there'll be a good debate on the state of the dairy sector here today in the seminars. But it's broadened it out into every sector, and that's reflected in the growth and the breadth of the number of standholders that are here now.
There are decisions being made at the moment, both in Westminster and Holyrood, which will impact the face of farming for probably decades to come. Will that also change how Scotland looks?
I'm not sure if it'll change how Scotland looks. I think you're right. You know, we are leaving the Common Agricultural Policy. We're right at the start of a journey as to how we put a new agricultural policy in place. Certainly as a union, we welcome the fact that that bill is now not just agriculture, but communities as well, because we certainly see farmers and crofters as being the heart of rural communities. But when you look at what the legislative programme is that's coming down the track, it's far wider and broader. So we know we'll have a land reform bill, we know we'll have a crofting law bill, we know we have a biodiversity bill coming forward, and we know there'll be further developments in terms of climate change, in terms of where the Scottish Government policy goes on that. So yeah, legislatively, there is change coming. You know, fundamentally, as an organisation, you know, representing the interests of farmers and crofters, we see farming and crofting as being at the heart of that debate. I think if you look after active farmers and crofters, then actually you're going to get the many myriad of benefits that government and legislation are looking for.
I suspect we are both old enough to remember the days when people spoke about problems rather than challenges with a hopeful gleam in their eye. Would you want to be starting farming just now?
Probably when I was younger, I didn't see myself as being a farmer. My degree is in pharmacy. But my first...
Bob, where did it go wrong?
Where did it go wrong? But my first ever job, and I did try to get into agricultural research back in the 80s, but my first ever job was with the Scottish Farmer newspaper. And it kind of went from there, and actually, the older I get, the closer I've got to farming and appreciating what a fantastic industry it is. So, yeah, I would love people to see this as a great place for a career. Some of the figures we're seeing around those who have applied to some of the SRUC courses this year are really, really positive. And I know as an organisation, we need to make sure we keep future-proofing what legislation is ahead of us to make sure that next generation of farmers see a positive route for them through the sector. And, you know, a good example of that is, you know, 2 weeks ago, we held our next generation group within NFU Scotland, held a hugely successful seminar looking at succession. So a very thorny topic for Scottish agriculture. How do you hand over the reins? When do you hand over the reins? What came from, and 180 people took part in the seminar, 100 completed a survey afterwards, and only a quarter reckoned they had a succession plan in place. So, you know, when we're talking about encouraging the next generation into the sector, that's a nettle we're really going to have to grasp. But there are also some very positive things taking place, and the Cabinet Secretary referred to it today. You know, the Scottish Land Matching Service, which is essentially a matchmaking service looking to set up those who want to get on in the industry and get the first step in the ladder with those who may be thinking of taking a step back in the ladder, is proving really worthwhile, and the Cabinet Secretary committed to additional funding and support through SEOS for that land matching service. So I think that's a great thing that we have in place in Scotland.
You ducked my question. Would you want to be starting farming in Scotland today?
I'll be perfectly honest, if I had to do it again, I would have started farming before I actually did.
Bob Caruth, Communications Director with NFUS, and we'll hear more from the AgriScot event a little later in the programme.
Yeah, nicely answered by Bob. Mm-hmm. No doom and gloom from Bob.
Nope. Saying,
well, you know, there could be challenges.
Yeah.
Just he wished he'd done it earlier, and I think that's true of a lot of farmers.
Yeah.
Now, have you heard
got rid of all that nasty money?
Yeah, don't need any of that to be happy.
Yeah.
Have you heard of green woodworking?
You're
bound
have.
To have heard of green woodworking.
Yeah.
So it involves making things out of unseasoned or unprocessed wood using only hand tools. Now, I know that you love using hand tools, don't you? Yeah, you'd have been in your element. Anyway, it was me that went to this one. It's a method.
Why?
It's a method which appears to be growing in popularity. There are all these kind of courses popping up now, which offers people the chance to make their own table or chair or whatever else. To find out a bit more, I joined green woodworker Aaron Sterrett at a forest near Forest.
Well done.
Green woodworking starts with the tree, selecting it, felling it, and then after that is cleaving the tree.
Okay, now what does that mean?
That basically means splitting. So we're going to split the wood. So under here, we've got some oak. Now, the reason why I keep it underneath a tarp... Oh,
hello.
There's a wee dormouse.
A little mice, very cute.
Oh, nice. It's so I can create homes for mice. Nope. It's so I can keep the moisture in the wood.
And that's the secret, isn't it, to green woodworking? You want the moisture to be in there rather than removed.
That's right, yeah. Yep. So that makes it easy to work with hand tools. You know, we don't need power tools if we've got moisture in the wood.
So it is looking quite damp, isn't it?
Yep. And it's oak, and oak is brilliant at holding its moisture, actually. I mean, I'm sure, there'll be some listeners who have found you go to saw an oak log and it's maybe been sat there for up to 10 years, and you go into it, it'll still be soaking wet in the middle. It just holds on to that moisture.
So I suppose that's annoying if you're trying to burn it, but if you're trying to create furniture, that's a plus.
Yeah, it's brilliant for green woodworking. Full of tannins as well, you know, so it can just be left and it's not going to rot away.
And are you looking for trees that have fallen down naturally?
Not really. I would say that actually it's best to leave those trees for nature. For the invertebrates, increase the biodiversity, nutrients back into the soil and all that. There's a lot of woodlands, they're planted or they're not particularly natural, so there's a lot of one species, so they can always do a bit of a thin. So it's those type of woodlands that I would usually get my wood from, if possible. Actually, my actions as a green woodworker can actually help increase the biodiversity in those woodlands.
How is that? Explain why that is.
It's considering yourself as almost an animal in that environment, and you're disturbing things, you know, by felling those trees. But by doing that, you're creating a bit more light. That would be one thing. So you've maybe got more plants then growing underneath, or an opportunity for another species of tree to come in. The other thing would be that you're leaving quite a lot of wood, so that would be the brash, and the unwanted bits of the tree on the ground. And that then is increasing the deadwood and, yeah, increasing the biodiversity that way.
Yeah, because we know that it's such useful habitat.
Yeah, yes, yeah. And we don't have enough of that at all in Britain. We need more of that because we've been a bit too neat and tidy.
So you've got a nice wedgy chunk here, as you say. So what are you going to do with it?
So I've got some chairs up in the workshop there that I'm working on, and I need some spindles, for the back. So now I've got to split it down further. And again, I'll start off with wedges, metal wedge, and a sledgehammer. It's going to get a bit noisy now.
How did you get into this way of working then? Because you mentioned that you were, you know, originally taught with seasoned wood.
Yeah, that's right. So I did a furniture crafts degree in Carlisle. It was inside with machines, and then I qualified with my degree. It was through necessity, actually. I was looking for a way to work with the wood and create pieces of furniture. I couldn't afford to buy these big machines, you know. And I actually came across a guy, a Scottish furniture maker, Adrian McCurdy, who makes absolutely stunning sculptural cleft oak pieces of furniture. That was a game changer for me, really, realising that you can create these beautiful pieces with just hand tools. If you listen close, you'll be able to hear it, just the fibres just breaking apart there. Push that apart. You've got to watch your feet at this point. Lovely. It smells wonderful as well. It's a real sort of vinegary smell, oak. And really for me it all comes down to the process. So it's what process is most enjoyable. And yeah, the process of green woodworking are so much healthier, really, you know.
So explain that.
Well, dust would be probably the biggest one. So often with power tools, you create a lot of dust, and obviously breathing that in is not so good. You've also got noise as well, you know, in that confined space in a workshop with noisy machinery. Yeah, it sort of offends all the senses, really, whereas this is the opposite. And we're just using really basic, simple hand tools.
I feel like I need to stand back now.
It's pretty safe. It's pretty primitive, this process, right enough, yeah.
Is that part of its appeal?
I think so. I mean, I've done this with huge big trees before, you know, and been able to break them up into smaller pieces and then just carry them out. You just rock up with a bucket of wedges and a sledgehammer, you know, and just your own power, your own muscle.
Yeah, you don't need any electricity here, of course.
Don't need anything like that. And actually, I'm always surprised at how quick it is. I still think it's probably the most efficient way to break down a tree into manageable sizes. Because, yeah, you're really working with the material.
And we'll find out how Aaron gets on with his spindles a little later in the programme. I've done green woodworking in the past, now, have you? And one of the most awful, I mean, really terrible experiences of my life was trying to use a saw pit. So you go down into the saw pit, and somebody stands above, effectively on a trestle, and you've got a log and whatever. And what you're trying to do is to cut the tree into planks.
Okay.
Right? So you've got this huge long saw up and down and up and down and what have you. But just find, but if you're down in the hole, all the stuff falling off the tree falls in you, usually in your eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, poor thing. I quite liked it.
Why did your career as a nurse never take off?
I don't know. Oh. I quite liked it as a process because, again, I felt that there was not so much scope for things going catastrophically wrong. If you take a saw out and you make a miscalculation, then that's possibly the end of your project. Whereas here it's quite a slow process, you know, you're shaving bits away. If you just go a little bit too far, you can probably still do something with it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I think that would probably suit my skills level.
The fact that it's green too, it's a different sort of feel to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's It's not the fact there's necessarily more resistance. It feels like you're working with a live product, which
that's
you're not,
right.
But, you know, by that stage. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah, and you really feel the tools as well. Yeah, I think it is. It's quite a nice process. I wouldn't say that I'm particularly good at it, but I can see why there is an appeal to it.
So what did you make?
I didn't make anything. I was just watching him making his spindles for his chair.
I thought you said dining table and 8 chairs. No problem at all.
We've also got a mystery sound for you today. Let's have a wee listen.
See, I have a feeling I should know what it is.
Well, someone's got it right already, apparently.
Oh,
yep, right already. You've got lots of time to guess, though. Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295, or you can just give us a ring the old-fashioned way, 08085 92 95 00.
Occasionally hear the fluttering of the carrier pigeons coming in. As we've heard earlier, I was at AgriScot this week hearing about the current state of play in the farming industry. But let's go to farming on a small scale now, in a very small scale, as a fact. In a setting you might not expect to be able to grow an abundance of fruit and veg.
Yeah, the Tappanoth Farm sits on the side of the hill of the same name near Riney in Aberdeenshire. It's been lovingly tended by James Reed and his family for the past decade. They've successfully run a veg box business and they've got goats, chickens and geese. And now they're establishing a food forest.
Trees form, and this is really interesting to my mind, form an intrinsic part of their approach. I mean, not just for shelter, but also for food. And not just for people, but for animals too. James explained more to Helen Needham.
It's really important to us that every element that we have on the farm, an element being the polytunnel, the garden, the cowshed, whatever you might have, it's very important that every element has multiple functions. So with the chicken run here, with the straw yard, yes, it's a place to have chickens for eggs or for meat, but it's also going to be a place to grow fruit trees, but it's also going to be a place to accumulate waste, which then turns into compost. So, and the great thing about planting the fruit trees in here that it's got this integrated pest management with the chickens underneath the fruit trees, taking care of any pest problems that might occur, making use of any windfalls and things like that.
The chickens are very useful and very happy, I would imagine they will be.
Yeah, they
roaming
will be.
Around here.
Yeah, they will be. They'll have plenty of space. We'll be happy too because they won't be getting out into our vegetable gardens.
Helping themselves.
Exactly. And they're very good at that. So this is connected to many areas of Forest Garden, which is our multi-species, multi-function areas of orchard. When we want, we can open a specific door and let the chickens out to roam around these areas of fruit tree orchards as well. So they've got lots of space, but it's been designed in a way that we know where they're going to be and we can put them to work as well.
Shall we take a wander through them?
Yeah, let's do that.
I'm most impressed that your daughter was doing some useful work there without even being asked.
I know, that's it. No, I'm amazed too. We've got a billy goat staying at the moment. This fine guy in the back there. He's called Gimli.
Wow, what a guy.
He's a bit stinky. He's done his business, yeah.
Right, so we're waiting. Confident.
Yeah, we've witnessed it, yeah. we keep the goats for home dairy. My partner Rosa is the main kind of goat keeper. Rosa makes cheese and different fermented milk products. Really great, and also they love eating trees.
I know, well I was just going to say that actually their enclosure has got loads of bits of tree here. What kind of tree?
This is willow that we've cut down where we're making the new chicken area. So they love willow.
They're just nibbling away at the leaves here. Yeah, how much of the tree do they actually eat?
Oh, they'll eat the leaves and they'll strip the bark off as well, so they'll get a lot of nutrients from the bark. It really is their natural diet is tree browse. They're more akin to deer, really. They love browsing up. And then we also make tree hay, which is cutting fresh branches kind of in midsummer and bundling them up and storing them to dry, just like regular hay. And then we feed it in winter when there's no leaves on the trees or there's no grass for them to graze. We give them the tree hay. We do a micro herd around the farm with them as well. That's walking the goats around the farm, through the forest, through the woods, moving them on when they start to look like they might be going to strip the bark off a tree. So we have to keep them moving. And it's great. As you can see, we have just a huge amount of tree brush that we can constantly feed. You know,
yeah. How satisfying.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it really is. I mean, we were talking just last night with Myla about a closed-loop system. We're cutting branches off of our own willow trees, feeding these branches to the goats. Once they've stripped off the leaves and the bark, we'll leave it in this field until next year for them to dry out. That becomes kindling and firewood at that point. We then take that wood into the house and burn it, and then the ashes go back out onto the compost heap, which the compost then gets taken to the young fruit trees or the young willow trees, which grow and get coppiced and cut and fed to the goats. So
full
it's
circle.
Yeah, full circle.
Where are we now, James?
Okay, well, we're in the West Field, but this is an area that we have just recently actually planted up to a fruit tree silver pasture.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so silver pasture is the integration of productive trees within grazing. So that could be trees for timber, could be wood fuel species. With us, we've decided to go with fruit and nut trees because that's what we want to grow here on the farm for home use, but also for the future to be able to provide fruit products to the local community. So if we take a wander up, you can start to identify the tree rows. And then we've got about a 12-metre grazing strip, and then our next tree row, and then that pattern gets repeated. So we rotate the goats, our geese, and the chickens all through these grazing strips in between the fruit trees using electric fencing so that the animals don't get to the trees. So we've put a really thick layer of goat bedding, as we call it. So we've mucked out the goat shed.
Again, the goats are coming
yes,
in handy.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so you can see the straw, which is around the fruit trees. So we've got apple trees, we've got black currants. There's various different shrubs and small trees and ground cover plants. So a large mass of roots all growing on contour. So we're hoping that that will have the effect of stopping and spreading the water out across that contour
capturing
line.
Capturing as it comes down.
Exactly. And with that, the nutrients from the grazing animals that are above that food system.
To me, what's jumping out here is the diversity of this planting. It's absolutely not a monoculture.
No, it's not. So what we're trying to achieve here is what we'd call a multi-strata or multi-layered agroforestry system. When we think of agroforestry, we quite often think of quite a simplistic design where we'll have a row of timber trees separating like a field of wheat or barley. And what we're trying to do is to put in as many layers of trees as possible, or at least as is practical for us, for our needs. So we're looking at what we would class as canopy species and shrub layers, herbaceous layers, right down to the ground cover layer. You can find up to around 7 layers within a forest garden or food forest, but it's not necessarily our goal to get all 7 layers.
James Reid there at Tabernoth Farm near Rhynie. And if you'd like to hear more about James's approach to sustainable farming, have a listen to the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now on BBC Sounds.
There's a big emphasis on agroforestry, isn't there? You were saying that they were also discussing it at AgriScot this week.
Well, you see, in the old days, you know, basically farmers, well, certainly in the northeast of Scotland, I think it's fair to say farmers did not like trees.
Mm-hmm.
Trees produced shade. Shade meant that the crops wouldn't grow in that particular area, etc. And you wanted to maximise every square inch of your land. However, you go to somewhere like Norway, and there is no, you know, so basically 20 years ago, 25 years ago here, you had forestry and you had farming. In Norway, they combined the two, and farmers saw that as a crop at the same time, a sustainable crop, and, you know, the shelter and everything else. So, you know, it's a different cultural approach.
Yeah, and that is what agroforestry is. Yeah, just combining the two, and often doing it in quite a clever way. And there's definitely more people doing that now.
Yes.
You know, I was at an apple farm, I was at a mini orchard this time last year, and they were doing it as well, and so huge benefits to it.
Yeah. I can't remember where I was, but they were feeding their beasts tree, they call it tree hage. Or treelage. Was it treelage?
Treelage, yeah.
Basically, it's just very, very fine branches. Is that? And the goats will actually take the bark off things. Well, they love the bark off branches and things. But it's just, you know, there are different ways of doing things. Some of them are going to work better than others.
Indeed.
Anyway, coming up, we're going all tree-tastic, mate, for National Tree Week, which obviously you knew it's in the diary. You wouldn't miss anything like that. And I go in a fantastic hut in Argyll.
Yeah. Do get in touch if you've any stories of trees with a personal significance to you. Have you ever planted a tree and watched it progress through the years? You know, we were discussing this in our meeting yesterday, and lots of people had very touching stories about planting trees, mm-hmm. like when their children were born, mm-hmm. or when someone had passed away. A nice way to mark that.
We've got one of those,
yeah, which is very nice. I have not such a touching story. I remember planting a tree with my granddad when I was little, and it turned out that he'd planted it far, far, far too close to the dike surrounding their house. And I remember as a young adult that same tree coming down.
Yes.
But yeah, you might have a more touching story. Do you get in touch with us?
I once spent 3 days bringing down a Leolandii with help, you know, a proper professional help, which was so enormous, and it was planted something like 7 feet away from the corner of our house.
Oof.
I thought, that can't continue. It's going to cope the house.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It's got to go. Of course, we've also got a mystery sound for you this morning. Let's have a listen. Some wrong answers, but we do have a right answer already.
Right one. Yeah.
Stuart Robertson from Pollock says, is the mystery sound a Dunnock? Great show as always.
Well, that's a thought, actually. It does sound a wee bit like a Dunnock. And Denise and Phil say, another wet start to the day in Rothes. Oh, it's aye wet in Rothes. Is today's mystery sound a corkscrew squeaking in the cork as I reluctantly open another bottle of wine for Denise? You know, I know the problem. I know the problem, Phil. I've been there. I feel your pain. And they say, our favourite tree's the Rowan tree.
I like how she's getting the blame. Ruth and Kinloss, morning, guys. Is the mystery sound a mouse keeping fit in a tiny treadmill? And Jim Greensmith, this sound occurs every year. It's the sound of Santa's sleigh gliding over the first snows of the year, coming from the North Pole to the Helensbrough Submarine Centre, which is undergoing a transformation into Coral Cove, Santa's one and only underwater grotto. Opening a week today on the 2nd of December, medley medley from Jim Greensmith.
They've got a great submarine in there.
Get in touch with your ideas, sensible or otherwise, out of doors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or you can ring 0885 92 95 00.
Have you ever been in there?
No, I haven't. Sounds good.
They have the submarine up there, you know, so it's above you. You can walk underneath the thing and whatever. But what they've done is really, really clever. They have it's like a sort of, it's like a projection system, but it's been modified to account for the shape of the submarine. You know, if you think it's not a flat screen, it's a it's a curved screen. So they've had to modify the image so it shows up right. But you can see the people moving about inside the submarine, outside the submarine. If that makes sense, fascinating.
Yeah,
absolutely
clever.
Fascinating. So, and if Santa's there too, for the love of goodness, what more could you ask for? Perthshire is known as Big Tree Country, and in Dunkeld, there's a trail on the Dunkeld House Estate featuring 18 specimens of pretty magnificent trees. I took a stroll along some of them with Catherine Leatherland of Perth and Kinross Countryside Trust.
The Dunkeld Tree Trail is a really nice, accessible, 3-kilometre circular route that starts at Dunkeld Cathedral and goes through the grounds to Dunkeld House Hotel and then loops back round along the River Tay back to the cathedral. So it's a really lovely walk that most people are able to do.
Yes. We're basically going through drifts of oak leaves and beech leaves, etc. at the moment.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Perthshire is known as Big Tree Country. And this basically is because we have a huge amount of tall, beautiful, spectacular trees and a vast amount of woodland in Perth and Kinross, more than you might find readily in other parts of the country. And that kind of dates back to the Victorian era, really, where people would go out and search for interesting tree species across the world and bring them back, and they planted them in great numbers in Perth and Kinross. So we kind of have the Victorians to thank for our amazing woodlands and our diversity of species in Perth and Kinross.
What all is on the route, I mean, that is of note?
So we have many of the spectacular species that would have come over during that Victorian era. We've got actually 18 different species highlighted along the tree trail, so you can read information about those particular species. But we've got a whole variety. We've got pines, oaks, spruces, we've got redwoods, and there's even a monkey puzzle tree at the end as well.
Okay. The colours at this time of year are spectacular. I mean, we're just going alongside the river at the moment, which is, it's not in spate, but it is pretty full. But just look at that, you know. All those tree trunks themselves are soft with mosses and lichens.
Yes,
and then you have rhododendron in the undercroft. Beach in the foreground here, so there's lots of coppers and greens and golds and things like that. Then the dark water. And then that whole bank across there is just covered in coppery coloured leaves.
Absolutely. The autumn colour here today is spectacular. Even though it's a little bit misty, we've not got a blue sky today, but this whole stretch along the river is absolutely beautiful because in part of all the different trees and the textures and colours that they provide. It's an absolutely beautiful stretch to walk down.
Dirty great big pine tree here.
Yes.
And again, the colours on the bark, it's a sort of, almost a sort of dusky pink, and then it goes on to sort of these light green, almost grey lichens, but right down at the bottom, that viridian moss.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and it's a great indicator of how healthy the ecosystem is here and how pure the air is as well when you've got these lichens and mosses growing on the branches of these different trees, sign of good air quality, just a really good, beautiful part of the countryside.
I understand that the Trust are working on something at the moment to a tree for every child.
Yes, so this is our flagship education project, A Tree for Every Child, and we work with different schools around Perth and Kinross to give the children a chance to learn about the trees in their area and why planting trees is important. So we learn about why it's important in terms of climate change, but also biodiversity and health and well-being. So we learn about all of those things, and then each class has the chance to come out and plant trees with us, and we help the schools to organise that in their local area. So it's direct action in their local area, being part of the community, and we hope that by having that direct connection with nature and that direct involvement, they will then care for those trees going forward.
I was about to say, the title, A Tree for Every Child, would tend to suggest that you're after some sense of ownership or custodianship or stewardship or however you want to call it, so that 40, 50 years from now, they're going to be taking their grandchildren back and saying, I planted that.
That's exactly it. We want them to have the ownership, to have that connection, because it means more that way. And as it's certainly in terms of learning, it's much more valuable to allow the kids to have that sense of ownership and that sense of pride that they've been involved and they've taken direct action for the climate. And you're absolutely right, we hope that as they go forward in their life, they'll grow and the tree that they've planted will grow with them, and they will share that with their family and friends.
What is it about trees particularly that fascinates you?
So trees are just amazing. I mean, there's so many things, almost hard to pick, but one of the things that gets me is their resilience. And we're actually coming up to a good stretch to illustrate this because we've got a wall on our left with trees growing directly above it. But I absolutely love it when you see tree roots branching around a big rock or through a wall, or the tree has fallen down, but it's got new branches growing vertically because it's persisting and it's able to survive. And I just love that. I think they're amazing living things, and there's just a magical feeling when you're surrounded by trees that it's kind of hard to explain. They're just wonderful.
We're just walking towards Dunkeld at the moment. We haven't quite come up arrest of the cathedral yet. But these are yew trees here.
Yes.
And it's effectively, we've come out of a much more heavily forested area.
Yes.
Almost into the light. And then you've got these two wee dark trees here. It's almost a statement piece up against the river.
Yes, and yews are actually one of my favourite kind of trees because they're just so wonderful and mythical in their kind of nature. And they often get linked to sort of eternity and eternal life. And there's a lot of mysticism around yew trees. So you often find them near religious places and in religious grounds. And they're just wonderful. I do like a yew tree. The bark of yew trees is really cool.
Yeah. These two small yew trees effectively are propping up. What kind of tree is that immediately above us? I thought it was... Oh, a squirrel. It's a red squirrel right up there.
Oh, wonderful.
Look at that. Just running right
fantastic.
Up and over the branch. Whatever type of tree this is, and I thought... I must confess, my original thought was it was a beech tree, but
same.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But the leaves on this have turned golden up against the dark needles of the yew tree, but they are floating down like this every so often.
Yeah, it's beautiful when you get that rain of autumn leaves and you're just standing there amongst the cascade of beautiful colours falling all around you. It's beautiful.
Catherine Leatherland of Perth and Kinross Countryside Trust at the Big Tree Trail in Dunkeld.
Yeah, and
I recommend it.
Spectacular just now, weren't they? And I like her passion for yew trees as well. They're particularly interesting. I like all their mythology and symbolism.
Nice to see the squirrel too. We're going to stick with trees now because, as we said earlier, it's the start of National Tree Week. Joining us to tell us all about it is John Stokes, Director of Tree Science and Research with the Tree Council. Good morning, John.
Good morning. How are you? Sounded beautiful where you were yesterday.
It was. Absolutely lovely. And you know, that very gentle rain of leaves, there was no wind, so they were falling absolutely vertically. You know, so that's always lovely when you see it. We said this. I mean, this is the 50th anniversary of National Tree Week. Am I right in thinking that you actually planted a tree back in 1970? How old are you?
Well, I'm afraid for my sins, I'm 50. I'm 58. I was seven when I planted the tree back in 73. And yes, you said that the children would be planting trees and coming back to remember them, and that really is one of the things about trees. I did plant a tree in 73, and I'm still here doing trees nearly 50 years later. So it is that connection that you make with the tree and the place that really makes trees special.
And the emphasis this year is on growing a tree rather than planting a tree. What does that mean, and why the change?
So, I don't know if any of you... You might not be as old as me, so you might not remember, but...
We are. Well, I am. She's not.
But there was a little bit of a rhyme that went with that back in 73. It was plant a tree in 73, plant some more in 74, still alive in 75, and dead as sticks by 76. because we had that really hot, dry summer in 76.
Of course, yeah.
And so the trees didn't make it, didn't survive. So, or some of them, not all of them, certainly ones that I planted survived. But now we're focused not on just the act of planting, but actually getting the tree to grow, and that's slightly more subtle. That means that you have to put some effort into keeping it alive. You have to look after it to get it through those droughts, to get it through those. And the first 3 years of a tree's life are the really most important, because that's the point where they need a bit of TLC and care. They need some water, they need a bit of moisture, they need some mulch around them to keep them growing. Once they've made it through those first 3 years, then they're pretty much all right. But so that's why we've had a change of emphasis from plant to grow, just to try and connect people to the idea that if you want it there in 50 years' time, you need to be putting some effort in to keep it going.
What does the Tree Council actually do?
Oh, so the Tree Council is the umbrella organisation for tree groups across the UK. We were set up really with a priority on the non-woodland trees. So the Forestry Commission were there to do the woodlands, but we were set up to do the non-woodland. So it was parks and gardens and street trees and all of those sorts of places are the places that we're encouraging people to plant trees. And of that 50 years, I've had the privilege of working here for 34 of them. So I really am one of those old tree people that's been involved in looking after and planting and managing trees. And each year, because of that plant a tree in 73, we've had this event, National Tree Week, which we're starting today, which is that focus on getting people out to plant trees. And in fact, there is the Countryside Trust that you were just talking to, I've actually got a planting this morning of about 1,500 trees down towards Aberfeldy. So it's to give people the opportunity to play a part, to plant a tree, and you just never know. Some of them might get as hooked as I did and be here in another 50 years talking about how they first planted a tree today. And that's what makes it real.
Well, I like that you describe yourself as an old tree man. Do you think that we need to be planting vast numbers of trees now, or how are we doing in relation to that?
So we do, for the Climate Change Committee published a report across Britain about how we could move towards net zero and climate change. And a large chunk for the tree people is that we had to do a lot of new tree planting across the country. And we're doing all right. We need to build up. It's like anything. We've got 30 years in which we have to get these trees started. And to get from where we have been to growing a lot more. Takes a lot of effort and thought and, you know, development. But we are definitely on the right track. I mean, just the practical thing, you know, if you're going to plant trees, you've got to have them. So where do you get, how are the businesses set up to grow those trees so that we have enough to meet demand? And that requires nurseries to start developing new quantities of trees. So it's taking a slow time to build up to the speed that we need to be working at, but we're definitely on the right track.
One more practical question, John. If you're thinking about planting a tree, is there something like some sort of tree line advice centre where you can say, what kind of tree should I be planting here? You know, I live in such and such, what kind of tree fits there?
So that's a really interesting question from two points. It's never quite that simple because the soil and the site and all those sorts of things vary. And it will also vary for the climate. As the climate changes, some of the trees won't necessarily fare as well as they've done in the past. But there's lots of information on our website, Tree Council website. There's lots of information from Forestry Commission about trees, choosing what tree to plant. And it is just seeking advice before you do it, but making sure you do choose the right tree for the right place, particularly if you're planting in a relatively small garden. You don't want to plant a tree that's going to become absolutely huge.
Well, but that's what happened.
Go to our website, have a look. There's lots of information there to help you.
Perfect. John, it's been a pleasure having you in the programme again. Thank you very much for your time.
It's lovely. And thank you very much indeed for helping us to start National Tree Week today.
Oh, no bother at all. No bother at all. It's our pleasure. John Stokes there from the National Tree Council.
Yeah, I'd quite like to plant a tree in our garden, but it is quite small. What I'd really like is an apple tree, but our apple tree had to come down because it was diseased. Okay. And the only real spot that we've got to plant the apple tree is in the spot that we had to remove the old one, and I don't know if that's advised or not. Should you plant it in the same area?
What kind of disease was it?
I don't know. That's just beyond me. Something that we couldn't do anything to save it, so it was a bad disease.
Yeah. Interesting. Anyway, we have been covering the Thousand Huts campaign in Scotland since its launch in 2011 here on Out of Doors. The aim really has been to encourage and support a culture of recreational hutting in Scotland along similar lines to places like Norway, where hutta, family huts, and just, you know, really not always simple places. You get luxury versions of Norway now too, but they offer places to be, just where the family can get away from, you know, where you normally are, and spend time together and just relax, and, you know, mostly they're online. Peter McQueen is the author of a new book, offline, not online. Peter McQueen is the author of a new book called The Art of Hutting. Now, the McQueens have a family hut in Argyll, more on the detail of that later, where, as he very kindly cooked me some sausages on the stove, he shared some of the long history of hutting in this country.
Scotland actually has a really interesting history with hutting. We've got some old hutting communities that came about after the First World War. Mm-hmm. That's the Carbeth community, and there's some other ones that are over on the Ayrshire coast. But if you look a wee bit further back than that, then we've always had an Ari culture, the Sheeling culture. People would migrate seasonally with their animals away from the nucleus village, and they would head out to the Aries, to the Sheelings. Mm-hmm. Just outside Oban, there's a place called Arriogan, which is Arriogan, which is Ewan's Ari. And so these places would be in a kind of satellite fashion around about village centres, and you would head there with your animals. Usually the people would set off on May Day, the 1st of May, La Buya Bialtin, and you would spend the summer there with your cattle, or sometimes sheep, or even ponies. And that made a lot of sense because it would allow the in-by crops to mature. And so the women and grannies and children would walk out to the Arrie, and the men would stay in the village, and they would fix the roofs and do a bit of work and tend with the vegetables and tend with the crops. And the people out at the Arrie were busy as well. They would be making butter and cheese and fixing clothes. And there's a rich folklore about that time. A lot of very happy songs about people visiting the Aries, and sometimes a bit of romance would occur there as well. I think there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing from the villages to the Aries. So in the Isle of Lewis, for example, we still have an example of Arie villages, and the people still use them. And although the use has changed, it's great to see people using those arrees up in Cuisheter for recreational purposes and heading out onto the moor.
In terms of hutting, I could build something very similar to this. My father and I would love to build something very similar to this. But it's actually finding someone who will, you know, either sell it to you or allow you to, you know, to rent it. It's getting that model established and obviously getting planning permission.
Yeah, I mean, there's unquestionably challenges with access to land in Scotland because such a small number of people own nearly all the land. But there are ways of accessing land, and I think if anybody has got an idea or a notion to go and build a hut, and Mark, you sound like you've got a hutter's heart, and I think there, there might be a new hut popping up in Aberdeenshire somewhere soon, but maybe don't be shy about approaching landowners and asking them, because if they have a piece of land that maybe isn't useful for agriculture and maybe they aren't using it for anything, they might be open to renting it or selling it. And through the work of Reforesting Scotland and the 1,000 Huts for Scotland campaign, there are great new examples of hutting sites popping up. So as the visibility of hutting increases, hopefully too will the understanding that maybe having people either on your land as a neighbour or as a tenant or selling a piece of land to someone for the purpose of hutting becomes more attractive, especially if it's a piece of ground that isn't turning a pound as it is.
What would it take to get the hutting movement in Scotland up and running in a way that lots of people could be enjoying this?
Well, I've mentioned the 1,000 Huts campaign, and they've been doing fantastic work for many years. And, you know, there's a strong group of individuals that are interested in both forestry and also people and the access to the land. And I think that they've been working hard with planning authorities. And so, for example, the planning authority definition of a hut was agreed in 2014. And that was actually what allowed my dad to build this hut. But they also did some work where in many instances you don't need a building warrant for the hut. So I think if you've got an interest in hutting, definitely go and speak to your local planning departments. Find out if they've granted huts in the past in their area. And if they haven't, then go and have a conversation with them and have a look at the Reforesting for Scotland website and check out that campaign, because all the information that you need is there. We've been filming for BBC Alibi the Garrig Fatrick series, the gardening programmes that I do for Alibi, and we've sort of been doing a lot of episodes from the hut. So that's increasing visibility of hutting, I hope, and in a good way. It shows that, you know, hutting is good for families, and it's important for families to have this type of access and to be able to live this type of life.
Why do you think hutting has to succeed?
You know, Scottish people are quite often seen as the sick man of Europe. We've got low life expectancy in certain areas in Scotland. We've got high drug and alcohol issues. We've got poor mental health, obesity. Poverty can take its mark on a lot of different aspects in our community. And yet we have one of the most beautiful nations in the world, where there's a lot of empty land there that was cleared, actually. So there were people in those glens and in those hills before. And I think that the return of the people to the land and having a connection to the land will facilitate much healthier cycles of lifestyle. And there's a very interesting project happening in the Carnock Woods just outside Dunfermline at Saline. And basically it's a pilot project with Forestry and Land Scotland, which is what was the Forestry Commission. And they manage a grand total of, I think, around about 8% of Scotland's total land. So if this pilot project is a success, and I think it will be, because, well, there's hutters already built their huts and they're in place there. And, you know, one lady in particular was the first to build her hut, Linda. And it's just been a delight to meet her and hear her take to the hutting lifestyle. And she lives just a few miles along the road, and the hut's the other place that she heads to. And when I went to visit her, we sat on her deck and we had coffee that she made on her stove, and we watched two red squirrels dancing in the trees. 600 people applied for one of those 12 sites. So the demand is very high. And if that site is a success, then we could see a lot more huts being built in public land. And, you know, that's why I think that the campaigners that have been working hard behind the scenes for all these years, they're to be commended, because they are the ones that are making a difference. But now we need new hutters. And so, yeah, if you want to build a hut, don't be disheartened about the access to land question, because there are ways and means. And I think it's going to get a whole lot better in the future, and there'll be a lot more huts to be seen and happy hutters around the country.
Peter McQueen there in their family hut.
No.
describe it then? I know you're desperate to.
Well, his dad did what I would have done, to be honest. He basically found some old double glazing units and then built the hut round about those. Mm. So it's got this enormous, you know, window space looking out across the sound. And then you've got the end of the island of Seal, and then behind that you've got Mull. So it means just wonderful location. Mm-hmm. But it's also tucked into the remnants of an old slate quarry. So there's a wee burn running down past the side of it. It's got running water. I would love that. And it's also slightly sheltered. And in the summertime, I don't think it's probably visible from the water at all.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
so
very private.
You know, it's by no means uncomfortable. By no means uncomfortable.
Well, they've got their own hot tub.
They've got their own hot tub, but they also have a sleeping loft upstairs and what have you. I think Peter said at one stage he'd a ton of pals in there. He says, never, ever, ever doing that. It was awful for all sorts of reasons. He says, keep it manageable, small groups of people and what have you. But just great to have that kind of access to the countryside and a refuge.
Oh, yeah, you know? Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned it's a nice place for you to go as a family.
Yes.
Probably also quite nice to go on your own for a bit of peace and quiet. Yeah, I can imagine a lot of people who want to crack on with something that doesn't require you being online would think, this is a good place I can go and spend some time actually getting some work done.
Well, you can hear more about Peter and his dad Graham's hut in the midweek edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which will be published next Wednesday on BBC Sounds. If you just put Scotland Outdoors into any search engine, you'll find it alongside a wealth of podcasts we've already published, which will keep you amused for hours, so it will. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Right next to me, cowering over the BBC fire at Beech Grove, is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of it, there's ways of listening again.
I am just dodging those sparks. You can catch...
Stop going on about the spark.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which you just mentioned, also available from BBC Sounds. We ask every week, tell us where you listen, because people listen in some very unusual places. We got this from Julie Ramsey this week. Says, I've just listened to this week's podcast as I sit in the shade on the Pacific coast of Costa Rica, Playa Potrero, to be precise. I'm on a three-week tour, and this has cooled me down just by listening.
Usually, I'm still in bed on a Saturday morning. This is fun for a change.
Thanks very much.
Keep up the good work, says Julie. This is my favourite listening.
If you fancy some company when you're tramping in the great outdoors or keeping cosy by the fire, I'd love you to join us on the Culture Scene podcast. Every week we take a burl around Scotland's arts and entertainment highlights and we hear from the folks behind them. Our guests so far have included artist Peter Howison, poet and playwright Liz Lockhead, actor Ashley Jensen and Church's Lauren Maybury. If that sounds up your street, get the kettle or your wellies on and subscribe to the Culture Scene on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for the mystery sound again. Have a listen. Jeez, difficult. David John Chadwick and Luke says, sounds bird-like, but I think it's more likely an insect, possibly a grasshopper, and adds his wife, and he will be taking advantage of the weather and might take the dogs along to the fallen rocks or perhaps further up the coastal path in Arran.
Nice. Ross in Tainalt says, morning, is the mystery sound a firecrest? And Kay in Ayr says, great to hear programmes from Monyshire, a wonderful source for outdoor activities. Is the mystery sound a dipper calling by running water?
Janet from Perth thought it might be a long-tailed tit chirping away.
Good
guess.
Which
I don't think it is.
No.
But I know it's not.
Good guess.
Because that's in the wrong guesses list. That's how I know.
Aye, yeah, yeah. That's because we've got the wrong answers.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
You see, we can claim to sound all knowledgeable.
Really.
Email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, or give us a buzz 08085 92 95 00 if you want to have a guess.
Time now to rejoin green woodworker Aaron Sterrett, who earlier on was busy making spindles for a wooden chair using unseasoned wood.
Yeah, Aaron runs courses for those interested in learning more about green woodworking at his outdoor wood workshop near Forest. It's very impressive as well. It's in the middle of some woods close to a river, which of course he thinks is the ideal environment for being creative.
It's where it belongs. The sense of space, really, I think that's really important. Yeah, when you're welcoming people. I've thought about it quite a lot, and I think what running the courses does is it allows that for people to be closer to nature. You know, they're creating something creating a piece of furniture that they need in their homes in a way that, if done right, actually is contributing to increasing biodiversity. I'm going to pick up a draw knife, just take the sheath off, and it's basically, you've got two handles there, and then the blade in the middle there. And I'm going to work on these corners here, and I'm just shaving back. So nice and slow, long shavings is what we're after.
Every piece that you create then has its own story. You know exactly where you got the wood from.
Yeah, yeah, really important as well, yeah. When I make all my pieces of furniture, you know, I can look at them and I played a part in every piece, you know, and I can remember the tree and where it came from. And there's a narrative there and a sense of belonging to the landscape, being a part of the landscape. I've taken great inspiration from the sort of Highland folk furniture of the past, where people didn't have much, but they just made these such rich, characterful pieces of furniture because they were born out of the landscape, you know. And they're often way more interesting and tactile than pieces that have been made in a sort of refined workshop, you know. And I think I'm going to have to adjust my shave force here. This wooden pin just pulls out. It's a holding device for holding these pieces of the wood we've just cleft.
Did you create a lot of these tools yourself?
So, yeah, these shave horses, yeah, I made them. They're not my own design. They're actually by a guy called Mike Abbott, and he's written quite a lot of books on green woodworking. And his whole idea behind this type of shave horse was that it would be very accessible to folk. And as you can see, it's just made by 2x4 bits of wood, you know. So you'd be able to get this wood from any builder's merchant. So, yeah, that was important to him, that anybody, you know, wherever you lived, you'd be able to build a shave horse.
Do you think if you remove the wood from this environment and you maybe take it to a workshop elsewhere, that you in some ways lose that connection with the environment and with nature?
I mean, nature's messy, isn't it? Nature's messy, and I think when you make a piece outside, it's going to be a bit messy. You know, there's going to be tool marks left on it. There might be a wee bit of dirt or a little bit of soil. And that all adds to it, doesn't it? It's another thing that I've noticed when people come on the courses. They maybe struggle with a bit at the beginning because we compare, don't we? You know, so you know, we're comparing to a sort of perfect piece, you know, that we've seen. If you're trying to do that in this environment, you're really working against things, you know, it's going to be tough. You really got to embrace the environment we're in. But when you take that into your home, then it's so rich, you know, because it's from outside. We're not going to sand away and polish away those tool marks. They're going to be visible, and that creates a narrative, a visual narrative.
And there is an appetite for it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, people go away. They ask for the plans for the shave horses, and they buy the few tools that you need. And they do, and they set up in their garden, and they make more pieces. And of course, it is for recreation, you know. And we've not really touched on the mental health and well-being, but it's massive benefits. Further down the line, you know, maybe we'll see more and more people choosing it as a viable option because it's affordable. You know, I need a stool, I need something wooden for my house, you know, something functional, and there are ways of making it sustainably just from the surrounding countryside.
This looks like quite a therapeutic process to me. You know, it's quite repetitive, and I mean that in a nice way.
Yeah, no, that's what it's all about. It is very repetitive. And yeah, it's lovely when folk come on the courses. You know, I'll maybe go up to get to another tool from the workshop up there, and when I come back down, silence. The only thing you could hear is that. And people are just totally engrossed in what they're doing. And when it comes to assembling these components and deciding where they go, that's actually where the real sort of skillful part comes in. yeah, you get an eye for that, you know. Because there's a fine line between a piece looking, you know, like a piece of art, or it looking awkward, you know.
Are you ever at the wrong side of that line?
Yeah, definitely. And it just depends on what way you're looking at the piece. You just walk around the chair the other direction. That looks amazing from that direction. Yeah.
You could just say it's meant to look like that.
Yeah, that's it. There's a great bit on the course, actually, when people make all their legs and it's time to fit them into the tops, decide which way they're going to go, and they get out into the woods, find some space, put the legs in, and then there's a lot of swapping about the legs and rotating them and stuff. And, you know, you always get that one leg that just sticks out, you know, at an angle, looks kind of awkward. But there's a lot of flexibility within the legs, you know. They rotate them a bit and it brings them in. We always get them looking good. Yeah.
Woodworker Aaron Sterrett.
Nothing worse than a dodgy leg.
Aye, it's the left one.
Just to complete the process, he dries out the spindles. And top tip, I said, where do you do that? Oh, in my car. It's a good place
in
to do
car.
It, yeah, in the car, yeah.
So you can say something like, in the Aga.
No. And then, because he's putting it into dry wood, he glues them in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I suppose that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to Ingleston now, to the agri... Oh, well, actually, there was... Well, we're talking about trees. Hang on a second, see if I can find it. There was some stuff came in... Hey, here we go. Saying... This is from Lackey, saying, when I was a youngster growing up in Aberdeenshire, not far from me, apparently, we had a favourite tree we imaginatively called the climbing tree. As you can imagine, it was easy to climb. It grew in a large space down at the farm buildings behind a silage pit. Its branches were wide and swept down to the ground, meaning you could walk into the tree without breaking stride. There was always a competition to see who could climb the highest. Usually the person who climbed the highest was the daftest, standing on tiny branches to be the champion. Every child, says Lackey, should climb a tree. It's a good place to be.
Chris in Murrayshire remembers the little poem that we just heard as well. It says, I remember as a school pupil back in the early 1970s we had a tree planting programme. It was called Plant a Tree in 73, then some more in 74, so they will survive in 75.
Dead at six in 76. Which is true, it was a very, very hot summer, 1976, it was brilliant. As I said, let's go back to Ingleston, AgriScot, which is the big farming event every year. Glenkiln Farm, they were given out awards. Glenkiln Farm on the island of Arran was recently the recipient of two awards, Scottish Diversified Farm of the Year, and also Champion of Champions at the inaugural Scottish Agricultural Awards. Now, a couple of members of the Bone family from Glenkiln were at the event, so Hannah and Ewan Bone told me more.
So it all started about 20 years ago. We used to be a dairy farm predominantly, and we just weren't making ends meet basically, and Dad couldn't take time off. We used to go on holiday with my mum and my granny, and Dad would have to stay at home working on the farm, so he knew something had to change then. So we started diversifying into, I think it was horse liveries first that mum started running, and then the profit from that helped us renovate a couple of old outbuildings into kind of holiday lets or long-term lets. From there, we built a couple more holiday lets that mum ran, and all the income from that and the horse liveries allowed us to look into building a hydroelectric power scheme. So we're involved in that. It was a joint venture between us and another company, and that was commissioned in 2016, and it's been a great success. From there,
we started our just finished last year, just opened up as our indoor riding arena, which I myself and my mum helped to run. So that's open to the public. The riding club on the island use that as well. Even the rugby club, they use that for indoor rugby training in the winter. So that's up and running now since last year, which has been good success. It's a 20x40 indoor riding arena. There are other arenas on Arran, but just not indoor. So,
have you diversified sufficiently far that your father can now go on holiday with you? And I ask that knowing that he's not here today.
he's been this holiday that himself and my mum are on, they've been planning this for 3 years. So I think there's been a couple of holidays they've planned and have been unable to get on. So,
do you think it's possible nowadays to actually run a farm just as a farm, or have you got to have other income streams coming in?
Just as a farm may not be viable. You kind of might just make ends meet, but no more.
And in other areas of the country, on like in like mainland Scotland or mainland UK, it might be viable. But living on an island where we live, I wouldn't say it's viable at all because of the increased costs importing and exporting goods. Just drive up all your costs and you're still getting the same outgoings as the rest of the farmers. So that's what makes it a lot harder.
That's a negative of actually trying to run a business on an island, but a positive of somewhere like Arran, Scotland in miniature, is the fact that you have enormous, what you might describe as natural capital, and it would be nuts not to take advantage of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, one other way we've diversified into kind of, because Arran is described as Scotland in miniature, and it's got a great tourism industry, Dad bought a pub in partnership with two of his friends. That was 5 or 6 years ago now. And we've renovated the inside of it and put a big extension onto it, new toilets and a big extension out into the front on the beach. And it was actually voted one of Britain's best 3 beer gardens as well. So
our next venture, Dad's looking into a Stepshire marina outside the pub. So that's our next.
Try bring more income into the pub.
So when you are selling food from the pub, yes, I take it you're using as much local produce as you can.
Beef and lamb from our farm.
Beef, lamb and venison.
Venison as well.
All come from the farm and are sold directly to the pub, which is great for the local community. And all the tourists coming down, they all want local produce now as well. So the fact that they can buy a Sunday roast or any sort of meat that's raised locally,
Just up the road, actually.
What you have here, just looking at the faces round about the ring, is a very engaged audience. You know, they're here to see, they're here to learn, they're here to get ideas. Great to see this level of enthusiasm. Can you tell me who you are and where you're from for a start?
I'm Robin Barr from Campbelltown.
What are you doing today, Rob?
I'm just up here at Aguscott, putting our cows out in the public eye, the shop window for the cows, to promote the breed. The Ayrshire cows, very dear to my heart, and my father and my grandfather, all the Ayrshire cows, and we're just carrying on with that tradition. My son's following me on, and we're sticking with our Ayrshire cows. I know.
Sentiment aside, Rob, why? Why do you think they're so good?
Well, we like our Ayrshire cows because they produce a high quality milk which commands a higher price in the market, and they're easier kept and maintained, and they more or less look after themselves, put it that way. They're not the hardest animals to keep.
Describe this beast in front of me at the moment. What makes it a good one?
This is actually off a red and white Holstein bull. We have two different classes in Ayrshire. We've got pure Ayrshires and cross Ayrshires, so this is off a red and white Holstein bull, and it gives them a bit more size. They're looking for big animals in the show ring, and maybe a bit more milk to them as well. You just got to look after that milk quality and keep the fat and protein right.
Are you going into the ring now?
I need to get into the ring now, but nice to talk to
you. Nice to talk to you too. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Good luck.
Farmer Robin Barr there from Campbelltown. Before that, we heard Hannah and Ewan Bone from Glenkill Farm in Arran. And we checked, and Robin actually won the Ayrshire Heifer Class. So well done to him.
Yeah, very well done. And we know why Hannah and Ewan's dad doesn't go on holiday. He owns a pub.
What's the point?
Exactly. Do you remember the colourful beach huts in North Berwick? You probably do, do you?
I do, as a matter of fact,
yeah. The sturdy structures were once a common sight during the summer holidays, but they fell out of favour by the 1970s and they disappeared from our coasts. Well, the Coastal Communities Museum has been lucky enough to be gifted one. I spoke to Judith Booth and curator Jenny Gordon, who gave me a guided tour. But first, here are the memories of Stuart Auld, whose family actually built the hut.
My first memories was as a youngster, because the family had a reserved hut, hut number 5, which was one of the green ones. They were yellow and green, and there was 36 of them on the beach. So we ran about the beach and met up with all these families. If you can just imagine 36 families occupying these huts with windbreaks between them, and the smell of methylated spirit stoves, lunch being cooked, kids running about. So we've met up with a whole lot of the Edinburgh kids, some of whom have settled here, others from the West Coast. And we had a great time there.
We're standing outside this fabulous beach hut. Just describe it for me and where it came from.
It's a timber beach hut, which is painted bright yellow, and it was donated to the museum by a man called Stuart Auld, whose great-grandfather, William Auld, first designed and made the beach huts in North Berwick. And I think the Olds are master craftsmen, and they took a lot of care and attention to make the huts very comfortable and easy to dismantle and store over the winter, so they didn't stay out in all weathers.
Let's go in and have a little look. It's actually quite spacious in here, and there's a seat, lots of cushions and a light. Tell me where you would have seen these then, and when was their heyday?
I think the heyday for the huts was the 1930s, really. That was when they were the most popular. And I think they were on the East Beach as well as the West Bay, weren't they?
And also in Gullen.
Yes, all along the coast.
And certainly when you look at old photographs, you can see, say, in the 1930s, lots of people on the beach and these lovely little beach huts in the background.
Yes, definitely. And I think families would have rented them by the week or by the month, particularly as somewhere to get changed on the beach, because in those days, I think people wouldn't have been quite so comfortable getting undressed and into their swimsuits in public.
Yeah, just by using a towel. I think we've all done that. It's not the easiest. This is actually quite spacious. You can see that a family could all hang out in here.
Yes, I think they'd have picnics and have days at the beach in the beach hut. Yeah.
The huts were built here on a wooden frame, and then they got timber cladding, and then you made the roof and made to the pattern, 6 foot square, the same as the other ones. The one in the museum, if you look at the structure of it, they were built like tanks. When I came in as an apprentice, the fun stopped there because it went straight from running about the beach to hands-on, which was hard work because the huts were taken down in the autumn, end of summer. They were sectional, 6 sections in each, 36 of them, were carried off the beach onto the golf course, piled up, put on a lorry and taken along to our furniture store in Standish Street and put into the basement, down a big sort of well with a ladder. And it took two men to handle each one, each section. So they were in there for the winter, and any painting repairs could be done, and it was quite a big cellar, big area. And in the spring, they were all hoisted out, put on a lorry, taken reverse procedure, put on the edge of the golf course at the starter's hut, and then they were carried down along the beach. In the 1960s, with the cheap holidays abroad, etc., they were falling off, and wages were going up, and the cost of them was getting higher and higher. Repairs, the hire of the lorry. The town council were charged for the beach, believe it or not. They had to be paid. And it got to the point where it just wasn't viable. So in the mid-70s, it was decided, look, they had to go.
Some of them ended up in back gardens, and Stuart did have one remaining hut in his workshop and offered to donate it to the museum so we could all get a feel of what the beach huts were like to sit in.
Yes. And you still see them in some back gardens.
Yes, if you've an eagle eye, if you walk around North Berwick and peek over garden walls, sometimes you can see a beach hut there.
It's interesting because during COVID times, I think we would have all been desperate for a space like this, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. A nice private space where you could go with your family and have a nice picnic and then get changed and have a sea swim.
When you stand here, do you feel almost quite nostalgic?
Yes, definitely. I think seaside towns in general have a lovely nostalgic feel and remind us all of being young and carefree and at the beach. So, yeah, they standing in this beach hut now feels very, very lovely.
Do you think there would be demand for them now?
Absolutely. I think with the advent of, or the resurgence in popularity of wild swimming, I think a lot of people would love to use a beach hut to get changed in.
So you never know, they might reappear.
That would be fabulous.
Knitted swimming costumes.
The very best kind.
Yeah, absolutely. That was Judith Booth and Jenny Gordon from the Coastal Communities Museum there, which is excellent, being in there too. You can hear more of the interview with Stuart Auld on the museum's website. And thanks very much to Room 8 Studio for allowing us to feature an extract from that interview.
Yeah, loads of correspondence today, actually, with some guesses for our mystery sound. Just before we get to that, Craig Wilson in Cardonald's been in touch to say, I have adopted 30 trees, all individually named, spread over Paisley, Cardonald, Glasgow Green and Glencoe Lochan. Greet them any time I'm passing. A great form of mindfulness.
That's excellent. Yes. John and Lewis from Ruthie Norman, we'll be doing a mystery sound. You'll hear it in a second, but these are wrong answers. Is the mystery sound a cricket? They are apparently recovering from Dingwall rare breed sale yesterday. Lots of bonny animals. But that A96, they say, through Elgin and Nairn is a total shocker. Yeah, the A96, the A90, the A9, they're all at it at the moment.
Well, we hear the mystery sound again. Well, let's have a wee blast.
I'll go for it.
Some more wrong guesses. Dave in Ammon Bank. Hello, I wonder if the mystery sound is the microphone close or in a wood ant's nest.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Heather from Linlithgow thought it might be a tree creeper. John McKenzie in Orkney thought it might be a red wing or autumnal Scandinavian rowan pickers. And Gavin and Cooper thought it might be a pipistrelle bat.
Ah, Kenny also thought maybe a tree creeper. Daniel in Forfar, good morning on this cold, frosty day. The mystery sound could be a wren. Thank you to the show's producers. It's a joy to listen to the programme. We're wondering if Daniel's maybe related to one of the show's producers.
I would have thought so. Yeah. I would have thought. I mean, people will be astonished at how little they have to do with it.
Andrew Barry in Broxburn says, the mystery noise, goldcrest. Craig from Bear's Den, is the mystery sound a large swan swizzling through the long grass?
Yeah, what?
Sandy Johnson in Langside, hi skies, the mystery sound a goldcrest. Quite a few people thinking that. And Nick, is it a ventriloquist blackbird trying to impersonate a red wing while smoking a cigarette?
It's none of those things. None of those things. The correct answer, and this came as something astonishing, is it's a waxwing.
Yeah. So there have been loads and loads of waxwings in Scotland this year.
Huge numbers of them.
Yeah, so you say. They were in Inverurie, for goodness sake.
Did you see them?
Yes. And
did you?
Because they weren't very far from our house. They were in the trees just down from our house.
They came and pecked at your nuts.
That's right. And I could tell that there was quite a lot of excitement because there were people out trying to spot them.
Right.
So okay. That alerted me to it. So quite a few people getting it correct in the end. Sean Morris singing a waxwing. Ian and Tully Nessel, good morning, Mark and Rachel. Is this morning's mystery sound some of the waxwings which have erupted into Scotland this year? Gorgeous birds. They certainly are.
Moira McLennican thought it was waxwings. Matilda from Perthshire thought it was waxwings. Thanks for a great programme.
Pamela and Alan Black in Edinburgh also getting it right.
Yeah. Right, we're having a bit of fun with the bacon this morning because the smoke is pouring off the bacon. But every morning, you know, on a Saturday morning, I go in at a certain time, say about 22, you know, and I put the bacon in the pan and I use about a wee knob of butter in. But this morning I opened the fridge and there's a block of lard sitting in the fridge with the words out of doors written on the top of it. And I thought, is this a culinary suggestion or is somebody being personal?
For a moment I thought you were going to say out of date. And I suddenly thought, I don't know if I fancy the bacon now.
No, and I don't know. I did sausages last week, as you remember, yeah. But they were quite well done.
They were, well, yeah, they were. I think they needed a little bit of scraping, but they were nice. They were nice.
Yeah. Once you decarbonise them,
yeah, we decarbonise them. This is incredibly smoky today, though. We can actually hardly read out the correct answers.
No,
can't see them.
It turns out that the mystery lardee was Ron, our audio supremo, who decided that the provender would be much improved.
Yeah.
By some proper fat.
It's doing my pre-Christmas diet no favours whatsoever.
Pre-Christmas diet, what a wonderful idea. I must try it some year. Anyway, that's it from us. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. on our midweek podcast, where you can hear more from Peter McQueen and his family hut in Argyll. That's all for this week, however, from all the team here in BBC Aberdeen. Stay out of the smoke, have a nice time, and thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.